Hello and welcome to the Tipsy Archives. I'm Rachel Leagy. This is the second part of the Polar Exploration episodes recorded by Aaron Redekop and Adam Hancock. And so you could listen to this one on your own if you really wanted, but I would definitely suggest maybe going and listening to the first episode. In that one, Aaron and Adam talk about the Franklin expedition with the HMS Terror and the HMS Erebus, and they also talk about explorer Charles Francis Hall. Some interesting and grisly mysteries in that episode. And in this episode, they continue on to talk about George Washington DeLong and the Jeannette expedition, Fridtjof Nansen and the Fram, and an interesting guy, Solomon André, who decides to ditch the ship altogether and get to the North Pole in a completely different way. So I'm hoping as I'm posting this in early March that we are finally done with snow here in Vancouver. It's been a particularly cold and wet and icy winter. Hopefully soon we won't have to be as cold as these guys were on their adventures. So I hope you enjoy the second part of our two-part episodes on polar exploration.
So the next guy I'd like to speak about is a relatively unknown explorer. He's definitely smaller. He's certainly smaller than Franklin in terms of legacy. He's also smaller than Hall. But he connects Hall with our next explorer, who's much more significant, in sort of a nice way. And so his name is George Washington DeLong. And much like in the 50s, when the Franklin expedition went lost and they sent out all those expeditions to find them, in the 2 years that the Polaris expedition was gone, so that was Hall's expedition, there were also a number of ships that were sent out to sort of look for them. So we expected them to be back faster.
So essentially, are they just, like, trying to make sure they're not drifting somewhere?
Yeah, they're trying to make sure that they're alive or they haven't wrecked. Because normally you'd say, we expect to be back in, you know, let's say 6 months, a year, three years. And if you're not back in that time, well, then they'll start dispatching rescue missions to see, let's find out what happened. Like, let's solve this mystery. So one of those was a ship sent out by the United States, and on that ship was George Washington DeLong. He was a naval officer. He was only 28 at the time. He's 28 years away from being named George Washington, which I feel everyone in the United States for a certain period of time was given that first and middle name.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. So they went to find the Polaris expedition, and I don't think they really found much. But in the end, he became quite interested with the idea of the Arctic.
Okay.
And his most famous expedition, which is the one we'll talk about next, and also, surprise, surprise, his last expedition, was based on a certain theory. And that theory is one that perhaps even Hall believed, which is in that of a warm polar sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea behind that is that there is a big region of cold water, but once you get past that, it's actually going to be open sea. So it'll be like the Atlantic or the Pacific, but at the top is just open water sitting there. Of course, we know that's not the case now. It's, for the time being, of course, frozen over at the top.
Yeah.
But DeLong wanted to try and find out, let's figure out how this works. We're going to sail north through San Francisco, and we're going to go up, and we're going to find the open sea, and we'll see what we can do there, and we'll hopefully find, you know, a nice passage, new trading routes, things like that. So that was what was called the Jeannette Expedition. So the Jeannette Expedition went north, it went through the Bering Sea. There's a certain irony here, because when they had made it, like, through the Bering Strait, and they made it up into what is now the Arctic Ocean, by that time, people had actually discovered that, no, the sea doesn't get any warmer. It's cold. It's cold the whole way up.
Never going to warm up.
So, exactly. So the whole purpose of their expedition was kind of moot. It was kind of very possibly, literally, two ships crossing in the night.
Okay.
So they would have gone up, and when they went up, they made their measurements and found out, oh, shit, it's cold.
Yeah.
So they went up, it was cold, they get caught in some ice, and it ends up drifting them towards Siberia. So they decide, all right, we're going to get off of this. We're not super far away from Siberia, And the men from that expedition would then go, and they'd end up at the mouth of the Lena River, which is one of the three great Siberian rivers. My apologies to the Amur River, which is technically not one of them.
Aww.
Yeah. So they would land at this very forbidding top of Russia River and find the people that lived there because there were known settlements there and get to freedom. Long story short, it didn't really happen. Some of them made it. Uh-huh. Some of them didn't. They got divided into three separate boats.
Okay.
One of the boats didn't make it.
Uh-huh.
Two of the boats made it. One of them made it very close to land and settled and survived. The one carrying DeLong sort of made it somewhere else, and ultimately they did not survive the winter. And that was basically that. And you might ask, why am I talking about this? And it's because of what happened to the Jeannette, which I find to be quite an interesting story. And evidently our next explorer found it very interesting as well.
It definitely helps him in deciding what he wanted to do.
It does. So what had happened was, it was stuck in the pack ice sort of around the New Siberian Islands north of the mouth of the Lena River. So what had happened was the ship was stuck north of Siberia in around the New Siberian Islands area. And this was in about 1878-1879. Not perfectly up on the exact year. And the interesting thing about it was the wreck of the Jeannette was then found eventually off the coast of Greenland.
Okay. So that's pretty far from
it's
where the wreck happened.
Very far away. And if you were to take a map of like a polar map and draw a line from the New Siberian Islands to Greenland, what would be right in the middle?
I don't know.
The North Pole.
Okay, that makes sense.
Indeed. And it wasn't a case of, we found this boat, what if it's that boat there? It was very clearly, they had the diaries, they had the nameplates, it was very, very well preserved.
So that they know that the boat has drifted from that point.
Yeah. They
through the North Pole.
Mm-hmm. So they knew where it got stuck, because some people survived and were able to say, this is where we got stuck. These are roughly the readings.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the diaries.
Yeah.
They were able to find, this is the boat. It's got exactly all of the stuff. It's incontrovertibly the boat. So now they know the pack ice drifts. So
essentially the Jeannette is the first to go to the North Pole.
Well, we don't know if it actually went to the North
Pole. Yeah, it doesn't
Pole.
Have onboard cameras. It doesn't have, like, Google Pro or whatever.
It also doesn't really exist any more than, say, an iceberg does. But on the other hand, it could be the first man-made thing to have gone to the North Pole.
Yes.
We'll never know. Also, just in case anyone's been wondering, we've been speaking about the geographic North Pole and not the magnetic North Pole.
They are different things.
They
what
are.
Is the difference?
One is what the compass points to, one is at the top of the world where all the spinning, where all the longitude is.
Okay, that makes sense.
There's a very specific definition where it's like, you know, equilateral to all this, whatever.
Which one does Santa live at?
Santa lives at the one in Finland, which is neither of them. He lives at the North Pole. Wink.
Too many North Poles.
I know. And then let's not get started about people who live in the north of Poland.
That would really confuse people.
I know. Anyway, so we'll forget about that. Maybe we won't even hear it. Maybe no one will hear this. So our next explorer, then, we can move on to, is a very, very fascinating man named Fridtjof Nansen.
So for our next explorer, we have decided to drink the Scuttlebutt Brewing Company Golden Mariner, and it has a picture of a captain on it who has a great mustache, just like our new explorer.
Yeah, he has a very nice mustache, Fridtjof Nansen.
And so Fridtjof Nansen is a Norwegian.
He is.
And he was a very daring Norwegian when he was a child. He went ski jumping and landed headfirst in a pile of snow, and everybody thought he'd broken his back. And then he emerged, and they all laughed like they do.
Immediately heaping scorn upon this person who seconds before may have been, you know, grievously wounded. Seems like a fairly standard kid thing to do, though.
It's what you do. It's what you do.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen one of those ski jump things in person, but they're quite high up.
I lived in Calgary during the Olympics, so I have seen it.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm a fairly accomplished skier, but I don't think I would have would ever enjoy going off of a standard ski jump.
I can't ski at all, but I've always wanted to go off of a ski jump.
I see. That's a very, very interesting illustration of contrasts.
I know. I'm a contrasting person. That's my music taste.
Indeed.
So, he's also a youth champion skier and ice skater. When I first read that, I thought it was a figure skater.
He was an ice skater.
He was an ice skater. I thought he was a figure skater at first, but I really doubt he was a figure skater.
I mean, he may have been. I mean, figure skating probably came along before, you know, the like short track and long track speed skatings.
That's true. Maybe he was a figure skater.
So let's just assume he was a figure skater. I mean, I understand we're supposed to be telling you the facts, but sometimes it's a little more fun just like, let's speculate.
Let's speculate this guy with a mustache being a really good figure skater.
He's a very handsome man with a mustache.
He's a very handsome man with a mustache. If you get a chance,
take a look at the young Fritjof Nansen, although he aged very well.
Yeah, he did. He aged...
I mean, not to give any spoilers.
Well, he aged to at least a point.
Indeed. And then he stopped aging.
That's what happens to most people.
Dun, dun, dun.
So he, again, doesn't begin... as a, like, polar explorer. He starts studying zoology. He is a curator at the Bergen Museum. He studies the central nervous system. He does a bunch of stuff like that. But then he becomes interested in polar expeditions.
As you would, living in Norway. He seems like he was quite a bit of a Renaissance man, in a sense, that he was interested in a lot of widely different things. Like, as I understand, he was one of the original people in Norway to pick up on sort of neuron theory, so the very, very early neurology there, which was quite interesting. And you'll see as we go on that he takes interests in things and he goes quite far with them.
Yeah. He tends to get quite obsessed with things.
So when he decides he's fascinated by polar and Arctic regions, what does he do?
Well, he decides that he wants to go and explore.
And where does he explore?
Well, he goes and explores Greenland. He's part of the first expedition to cross Greenland.
Mm-hmm. And a number of people had tried, and they'd all tried sort of in what was the standard way. Most of the civilization was on the west coast of Greenland, which is the farther away from Norway and Europe side of Greenland, for those of you unfamiliar with basic geography. But one of the problems here was the east side, it was almost impossible to get picked up by a ship on, because for the same reason there's no settlements, very forbidding coastline, it's quite difficult. So everyone who had done it had tried to go from west to east. There's a place called, and I'm not making this up, you know, shame on me if I am. It's called Disko Bay.
It is called Disko Bay.
So, you know, these countries... Remember, Norway was in a personal union with Sweden at the time. Mm-hmm. Wink, wink. So, you know, perhaps ABBA got some inspiration from this as well, as we all know. The other famous Nordic exports. And so everyone would go to Disko Bay and then go west to east. And so they would never make it.
Yeah. Well, and he gets the idea from that, that part of the reasons why the explorations have failed is because they're not going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. They're taking twice as much food.
Yeah.
So he kind of got it in his head that he would, you know, once again do things similar to what Charles Francis Hall did and, you know, sort of get native expertise. So he took relatively minimal supplies, mm-hmm. got dropped off on the east end. And he actually didn't end up where he thought he was going to. He kind of made a judgment call halfway through. And it's also fairly humorous to note, before this, he had just finished writing his doctoral thesis. And he immediately finished writing his thesis, submitted it, then went off to be the first person to cross Greenland.
Like you do.
Like you do. And so he makes it across Greenland.
Okay.
And he ends up in this settlement, and there's a Danish representative, because Greenland, I guess, was Danish, and I guess it still is Danish in a sense there. I'm not really sure how it works right now.
I don't really know much about Greenland.
I believe they have a fairly strong amount of autonomy, but are still technically a possession of the Danish crown. It's got their own flag now.
Yeah, but I don't think they're an independent country or anything.
No, they don't have a seat on the United Nations, but they're accepted as an independent country within the Kingdom of Denmark, which
is sort of like Scotland?
with even more autonomy than Scotland.
Okay.
It's a really beautiful flag they have, though. It's a lovely circle bisected by a line with red and white. It's quite lovely. Look it up.
You know too much about flags.
I know quite a bit about flags. My sister is in Nicaragua right now. And whenever I travel somewhere, I take a photo of myself next to the flag. It's my flag photo. I'm often standing arms crossed with a kind of pointing up perspective. Look at me, I have conquered this place because I was able to buy a plane, a train ticket kind of thing. My sister, I thought she was going to Costa Rica. She sent me a picture the other day of her doing the Adam, taking a flag photo. And I looked at it and I was like, well, that's not Costa Rica. I was like, I thought you were in Costa Rica. Why is the Nicaragua's flag? Anyway, they flew in there. Where are we going? Flags.
Flags. I like them.
So he makes it across. And the Danish representative of whatever town he's in, I think it's what was then called Gotthard, is now called Nuuk. And the first thing the Danish representative says to the person who's just crossed all of Greenland for the first time is?
I have no idea.
He says, congratulations, you've been awarded your doctorate.
Well, I mean, your doctorate takes a lot of time, too, so yeah. He's probably pretty excited.
Well, Nansen said that there couldn't have been anything further from your mind. He's like, look, I just crossed Greenland, and you're telling me that I wrote a good paper.
So he'd rather know, be like, congratulations, you just crossed Greenland?
I think that was the validation he was looking for.
That's fair. Having never crossed Greenland, Port got a doctorate, I don't really know.
I mean, I've crossed Greenland on a plane, but, you know, not by land.
I crossed Greenland, like, 2 weeks ago on a plane.
Yeah, I hope we got a chance to look at it. It's beautiful.
I didn't. It was, like, very dark outside when we were crossing Greenland.
Fair.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he comes back. He becomes more or less a celebrity. And, you know, he writes a book about his adventures across Greenland. He buys a house and stuff with the proceeds. He marries a young woman named Eva. Is there anything interesting about her? Oh, yeah, she trained with one of Tchaikovsky's paramours.
Yeah.
As a classical singer, which I find quite interesting.
That is really, really interesting.
And he will be the first of the Russian composers that we'll be talking about today, or mentioning today. Do you have a favorite Tchaikovsky?
No, I don't really.
Okay. He's got, like, Swan Lake, he's got the 1812 Overture.
Yeah.
He's got a couple of pretty good symphonies.
I've seen Swan Lake, it's really good. I'm not really a ballet person, but I really enjoy Swan Lake. But no, I don't really have a favorite Tchaikovsky.
He also has that, I believe, putting myself out there, but I think he did also a Romeo and Juliet one with, like, the sort of common, like, oh, these people are falling in love in background music.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's also Tchaikovsky.
I think so.
Anyway,
yes, definitely.
Digressing more than normal right now.
Yes.
So, after a while, so about 3 years after the Jeanette, which we had talked about previously, mm-hmm. George Washington, the long ship, it shows up around Greenland.
Yeah.
And what does that do to Nansen?
Well, because he's seen the Jeanette drift through, he realizes that that might be a way to go and actually see the pole and get to the pole. Is he believes that there is a polar drift that will pull ships through the pole.
And he's absolutely correct in that polar drift is very much a thing. The Jeanette basically proved it. The idea that it would take you to the way you want it to go seems a little more specious to me.
Yeah, because nobody knows exactly where the Jeanette has gone at mm-hmm. this time. They just know that it went in at one point and emerged at one point. They don't know what it saw.
But you draw a line and the North Pole would be right there.
So hopefully it went there.
Yeah, so that's kind of what he went on, and he decided, you know, I want to... He's sort of inverting logic on its head. Like, we've heard about the Franklin Expedition and the Polaris and the Jeanette, and they all sort of met their doom, or a doom, mm-hmm. when they got encased in ice.
Yeah. And so this is taking the getting yourself encased in ice and using it to your advantage.
Exactly. So they built a brand new ship called the Fram. It's Norwegian for forward. If you ever end up in Oslo, there's an excellent, excellent museum about it.
Yeah, because you've actually seen the Fram.
Well, spoilers. But yes, I have seen the Fram. It was used very famously a second time as well, which hopefully we'll have another chance to talk about later. But the Fram is built as a rounder ship than normal. Mm-hmm. It's built so that ice won't be able to grab onto it, and it'll be able to better withstand the pressures of the pack ice. So in 1893, I believe, He gets his ship. He populates it with people. Everyone's throwing him these big parties as he sails around Norway. Everyone's like, he's just the talk of every town. He's going to go, and he's going to conquer the pole.
Well, and the Fram's a lot smaller than the previous ships that have been used, because he's using a small maneuverable ship, right?
Yeah, it's much more maneuverable. It's made of incredibly hard wood.
Yeah.
Phrasing.
And he only takes 12 men with him, too.
He only takes 12 men?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a lot smaller of an expedition.
More manageable, fewer personalities to clash, perhaps.
Well, and there's only one person in charge, so so far he's off to a better start.
Yeah, so he spends... So the first thing he does is he has a kid with his wife, of course, and almost immediately after they're born, sails off on an expedition.
Like you do.
I mean, it was, you know, the 19th century, I suppose what she thought didn't particularly matter.
That's true.
But at least she gets to raise her kid however she wants. No news on how we turned... how she turned out.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he sails... And he decides to sail all the way around the north of Russia to the New Siberian Islands, which is, if you've ever looked at a map of Russia, unlike Canada, it doesn't have a big maze of islands, but it has sort of, like, they're spread out all along. And it, these are fairly far east. They're to the north of Siberia, and it takes them 3 or 4 months to get there.
And they're impeded by fog and ice and a dead water phenomenon while they're trying to do that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so tell me more about this dead water.
So, a dead water phenomenon is a layer of fresh water or brackish water, and it rests on top of, like, the dense salt water, and they don't mix together, and it makes it almost impossible for any ship that is moving forward with a propeller to make its way through.
So, like, propellers just don't work there.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
So...
A doldrums for a new mechanical age.
Essentially, yeah. And that's where you get, like, the dead water, because you're just sort of, like, stuck in it. But yeah, eventually they're able to get through, even though it's really hard to, maneuver through and really hard to move, but they finally do get through.
So, they end up getting to about the New Siberian Islands, which I understand is a really weird name for an island chain. But it's what they're called.
That, yeah, it does seem like very strange.
And, yeah, they lock themselves in the ice. The ice freezes up around them.
Stop the engines?
Yeah, stop the engines. They pull the rudder up so they're not going to ruin anything. And...
Drift?
They wait.
Yeah, like you do.
They wait for a long time. And this is a thing that strikes me as pretty interesting, and we haven't really touched on yet, is the Franklin expedition from when it took off. You know, it probably takes 30 days to get across the ocean, maybe 40 days. But it's about 2.5 years almost before the ships break up and they have to abandon it.
Yeah.
2 years, and you're stuck with the same 30 to 40 people.
Yeah.
In a small room. I mean, it's probably pretty smelly.
The ships, like, I haven't been on a ship like that, but when I was in Amsterdam about 3 weeks ago, I went on to one of the trading ships. And, like, the ceilings are really low. Mm-hmm. It's really dark. Like, I'm 5'3", and I'm having to duck to get through places. So I can only imagine what life would have been like for people on the ship.
Yeah, so it seems like quite a bit. And again, with Nansen, they're very bored. Life is incredibly, interminably dull.
Yeah, well, and you're just seeing the same things outside. Because they're not going very fast. They're going, like, 1 kilometer a day or something like that.
You're going at whatever the rate of pack ice drift is. I've got no idea what that is.
I read somewhere, I think it was, like, 1 or 1.6 kilometers a day.
Yeah, and they had no control over where it was going.
Yeah, and that was where the problem started to happen, is they started to go a bit more south than they wanted.
Yeah, they started going south, but eventually they realized, it was after Norwegian National Day, they realized they had drifted farther north than anyone had been before. When we left off, farthest north was attained by Hall. In the meantime, other people had taken the claim, but now Nansen and him and the Fram, he and the Fram, and he? I'm not really sure. Beers will do that to you. And they ended up further north than anyone had been.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still bored out of their skulls. Everything's going fine.
Yeah.
They've got enough food. Another thing is, like, unlike the Franklin expedition, is that they were like, okay, we'll go along and we'll shoot our food.
Mm-hmm.
So they shot polar bears and seals, of which there were I mean, there's not, it's not teeming with them,
yeah,
but there's enough to feed 12 people.
Well, and they did bring food along. They brought, like, yeah, 5 years of food along, too. Okay. So, yeah.
But they weren't as overburdened as the Franklin.
Well, yeah, they weren't, they weren't solely reliant on the food that they brought along. Mm-hmm. They did hunt as they went along.
So, yeah, so they, you know, they cleaned up the ship. They kept things in ship shape. They had pretty good discipline. They learned how to dog sled, because I guess some of them didn't know how to drive sled dogs, which was... If you're going to take sled dogs up there, you might want to know how to ride them around. But eventually, Nansen does some math.
Yep. And he realizes how long it's going to take to get
there.
How
long is it going to take to get there?
I can't remember, but it's like 5 years or something.
Yeah,
he's
like, at this rate, if we're going towards the North Pole, which at the end, you know, at first it's, you got a pretty broad swath north, but then you eventually have to get to the farthest north.
Yeah.
It's going to take them 5 years.
And he's like, we don't really want to spend 5 years on this boat. And we don't really have enough food to stay on this boat for 5 years.
So what does he do?
So he decides to take dog sleds and go up to the pole.
I think it's just cross-country skis.
No, it's dog sleds.
Is it dog sleds too?
It's dog sleds.
Ooh. Well, how about that? So I completely missed the fact that it was dog sleds.
Yeah, no, so they take their dog sleds. So it's actually only two of them. It is just Nansen and a man named Johansson. And so, yeah, they decide to go by dog sled to the pole, and the Fram is going to continue drifting until it gets to the North Atlantic.
Yeah, so you've got 10 people there, and they're like, okay, bye, we'll just stay here doing nothing,
we'll
I guess.
Play cards and look at the lovely ice.
Yeah, so, yeah, Nansen and Johansson head north.
They head north. They make for the pole. They are originally making really good time. They're like multiple days ahead of what they thought they were going to be able to, or the speed that they thought they were going to be able to go at. But then they get stuck with a drift as well, a polar drift. And so the ice is starting to go in the direction that they are not going in.
And they basically don't move anywhere.
Yeah, essentially, like, every time they move forward, they wind up going back.
Yeah, and they're measuring. So when you're at that sort of latitude, you measure yourselves with, like, sextants and things like that.
Yeah.
So they realized they weren't making very much, but they've definitely been further north than any other recorded human being.
Yeah.
At a certain point, they say, you know what? We're not going to make it.
We won't. We should probably turn back. And I believe he writes something in his journal about that series, like, we just have to go back.
Yeah, which is shockingly level-headed.
Yeah, compared to everybody else we've encountered so far, that seems very level-headed.
So, yeah, they head back. Apparently, going back, they set out for a place called Franz Josef Land,
mm-hmm.
which is in, once again, the north of Russia. It's forbidding nothingness.
Yeah.
But they know that there's a research station there, so they decide to head for that.
They do, and they've got a bunch of dogs and a dog sled, or possibly two dog sleds, and some kayaks and some food, and they set off to do that. And then at some point, the ice that they're on, because the weather starts to warm up, the ice starts to break off and they start drifting.
Mm.
Just like the people in the Hall expedition.
Well, as we recall, those people from that Hall expedition made it.
Shockingly.
So all is not a disaster for Nansen yet.
So your goal, essentially, should be, I guess, to get on a floating piece of ice that is drifting the direction that you want to go.
Indeed. And eventually they manage to make it to Franz Josef Land, and they end up on land. Because most of this time, they've just been on ice on top of water, which is... That kind of blows my mind, that you're like, it's solid, but there's actually no earth beneath you.
Yeah, that would be really scary, because you're like, if it warms up, I'm going to plunge into, like, the cold.
Well, I think it'd have to warm up an awful lot, and a lot of those places that ice is still there.
Yeah, but
pretty far north.
Yeah, that's fair. So yeah,
we're talking like, you know, kilometer deep pack ice here.
Yeah, but I mean, what if it broke off while you were sleeping and you fell into the crack?
Then you would be very cold and probably very soon squished.
I think you're gonna die very quickly.
There's a lot of ways to die up there.
Yeah, there's a lot.
So yeah, eventually they make it there. They camp out, the two of them together, for a winter, basically.
Yeah.
Which also kind of blows my mind that they set this place where it's just like, okay, let's just hang out here.
And we're gonna go shoot things.
Yep, and I go, and they do that. They shoot things, they live in a little hut. I think they had, like, a sailing almanac they could read, and they read that to each other. Basically became kind of like BFFs living there, because it was either that or go crazy.
Well, I feel like that person either becomes your BFF or your mortal enemy.
And neither of them killed one another, so... Well, not entirely true. We'll get to that later. So it must have gone along well. And one day, this is probably 1897, I would say, they meet this man named Jackson. And they were about to strike camp one day, and Nansen thought he heard a dog.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to go investigate that. And he sees a person, and this person's like, oh.
There's a person here.
There's a person here. I don't know how a person could be here. He looks like hell.
Yeah.
And so the exchange, it was more or less, yeah, well, was it or wasn't it? Well, we can decide if it's a Dr. Livingston, I presume. Where he turns to him and says, so you must be Nansen. And Nansen replies, yes, I am Nansen.
I am.
So a funny thing about this, so they, at that point, are rescued.
Yeah.
They've met up with a whaling station a research station in Franz Josef Land. Someone will show up eventually and come and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
A fun thing I read about the relations between Johansen and Nansen is it took about 6 months before Nansen would actually start referring to Johansen as anything other than Mr. Johansen.
Like when they were out there?
Yeah, when they were together. There's no first name, there's no familiarity. It was always Dr. Nansen and Mr. Johansen.
That's really interesting.
Until like 6 or 7 months in, and they must have been, well, Fitchoff.
let's make this a little bit less formal.
Exactly. I feel at a certain point, you know, you've been living in the same tiny little snow hut.
Yeah,
you might as well adopt the more familiar tone of address.
She's probably seen and heard things that most people haven't, so. But
yeah, it's kind of a peculiar insight into what was presumably one of Nansen's rules, because he's very serious, very stoic type person.
Yeah.
So maybe this was just another one of his, let's not break down those barriers. Like, I'm running this and you're just my partner kind of thing. Not, we're friends.
But
eventually, friendships blossom even in the hardest circumstances.
Well, I would hope so. Otherwise, it would be a very, very lonely trip.
A very lonely trip. So, yeah. So that makes you wonder, what's happening on the Fram?
Where is the Fram now? So, essentially, the Fram is just still floating along.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
And they've tracked the Fram's movements. And after 3 years in the ice, it just gets spat out the other side.
Yep.
And
right where Nansen said it was going to pop out, too.
Yeah. However, nowhere near the North Pole.
No.
Although strangely near, only about 100 kilometers or miles further south than the farthest north that Nansen made it.
Huh.
So in the end, it started going north-ish, but not as far north as they did.
Interesting.
And so what did they do? They're like, well, we've got a boat again.
Yep.
They just sailed it home. And Nansen arrived in northern Norway.
Yeah.
And was treated like a hero. And he's like, what news at the Fram? And they're like, what Fram? We've never heard of it.
Yeah.
Or, well, of course they've heard of it, but they haven't heard any news.
Yeah, it's still missing.
And then 5 days later,
Here it is.
And it's just this amazing coincidence.
When he goes up to meet it as well. Yeah.
Hello, gents.
Yeah.
How's it going? And they are, of course, an enormous media sensation there.
Yeah.
So in the years following, so they arrived back in September of 1897, and he had written 300,000 words about it by November.
Wow.
So, like, take that, November's National Novel Writing Month, and shove it, because he basically did six times that. He's essentially Hamilton. And continuing with the polymath thing, so he gets back, he's now very famous, you know, the king is like, hey, congratulations, he sees his wife, and presumably for the first time, his now 5 or 6 year old daughter.
He's like, hello, you were like the size of a peanut when I left.
Exactly, and then they promptly make another one.
Yeah.
As you would.
Well, if you've been gone for that long.
Exactly. So, yeah, he becomes friends with the king, gets pressed into diplomatic service. He's highly influential in the amicable separation in 1905 of Norway and Sweden into Norway and Sweden.
Which is how we know it.
Exactly. He becomes an ambassador to London. He negotiates a bunch of trade deals, all sorts of interesting things. He becomes a huge proponent of the League of Nations.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Not everyone was, but he was super into it. He traveled a lot after the First World War.
Yeah, well, and he is responsible for the Nansen paper, or passports,
after
the First World War.
Exactly, there, and the Nansen passports are basically stateless, or they're passports for stateless people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess we have similar, would it be like a refugee passport now?
Essentially, yeah.
And the idea is, you know, you make it so that someone whose state has kind of disintegrated,
mm-hmm.
Let them legally cross borders, right? So if you're a refugee, you're no longer stuck in the country that you tried to refugee. And that was called the Nansen passport. And it was used by a number of quite famous people.
Really?
Yeah.
Like
so,
who?
Anna Pavlova, the famous ballerina who no one can ever decide whether the Australians or New Zealanders originally named a dessert after her.
Right.
And one of my favorite arguments of all time.
It's a good argument.
Marc Chagall.
Oh, yeah.
The Belarusian-French artist. I would say he's post-impressionist. That would be my take on what Chagall does.
Yeah. Chagall's actually one of my favorite artists of all time.
So what would you describe his school?
I don't really actually know. I just call it something I like.
Okay.
I think it's adorable.
How
That's
green
why
is your
I
village
like
is what I'm asking here.
Yeah. It's very green.
Mm. It is perfect. It's fairly green.
Yeah.
And Igor Stravinsky also had an Nansen passport.
Really?
And there's a second Russian composer.
Yeah.
Also, who did that, Liz?
That is true, they both did.
Caused more riots with his, though, as I recall.
I don't know nearly as much about his.
I believe the famous story going around is that after the Rite of Spring debuted, and it was a quite jarring, more atonal piece of work, and the dance was very sort of ritualistic and shamanistic almost, the audience rioted.
Really?
Because people would riot about their ballets back then if they were that daring and that provocative.
Well, we live in Vancouver, we riot over everything.
Well, we won't be rioting about anything for a while now, if you ask me.
Melon Les Guns N' Roses comes to town.
Oh, that's true. Well, I feel that's as unlikely as a winning season for the Canucks in the next 3 years. So.
That sounds about right.
So, yeah. So, a lot of his passport work, he got really interested in this because he traveled in Russia during the post-World War I era when it was suffering massive famines.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of work as well with the Armenian people who were... The Armenian genocide was happening at that time in Turkey. So, he was concentrating on a way to help relocate Armenians into what was then Soviet Armenia.
Right. Well, and that's what he's working on when he dies, right?
No, he actually manages to complete a lot of that work.
Oh, okay.
His main... another interesting weird historical tidbit here is that his main collaborator with that, and
mm-hmm.
emphasis on the word collaborator,
mm-hmm.
Is everyone's favorite Norwegian collaborator, Viking Quisling, who famously collaborated with the Nazis in World War II.
I did not know that.
I did not know that either. I was like, this, so you can see that Fridtjof Nansen really has his hands in all sorts of pies. He's not just, he's not just a doctorate of the natural scientists,
mm-hmm.
of the natural sciences, and he's not just a polar explorer.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just a ambassador.
Figure skater.
Not just a figure skater or a ski jumper.
Yeah.
He's all of these things. And he eventually is awarded a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Which I believe is for his work with the passports.
Yeah, I believe so.
So it's a Nobel Peace Prize. And eventually, I believe his foundation, founded after his death,
yeah,
was also awarded a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes, it is.
So, anyway, Fridtjof Nansen. One of the coolest guys I'd never heard anything about before I went to Norway.
One of the coolest guys I'd never heard of before you went to Norway either.
Yeah, so he eventually lived a long life.
Mm-hmm.
And died.
He also probably had the best mustache of all of the explorers that we are talking about.
I have not looked at all of them, but I would not disagree for a second.
It's a really good mustache. It's a really, really good mustache.
So, a sad epilogue to the story is that Johansson, his partner on the ice floes,
mm-hmm.
Committed suicide soon after returning.
I did not know that. Because of having to be stuck on an iceberg with him?
I'm not sure. But he ended up committing suicide, and that's unfortunate.
Uh-huh.
So that's how this happy ending can have a slightly macabre twist.
Well, it's probably a fairly traumatizing experience to get stuck on an iceberg for that long.
Exactly, yeah, it would be. It would be fairly tough. But, you know, the Norwegians are a hardy type.
You've got to be to live that far north.
Yeah, well, there's a saying that they have, there's no bad weather, just bad clothes. Which is kind of obnoxious in a Lululemon kind of way, but also a little bit true.
It sounds, well, because you were there in the summer and it was still pretty cold.
A lot of rain there, yeah.
Yeah.
So, just one more story to talk about now.
Uh-huh.
And this one's one of those what were they thinking type ones.
Yeah, this one I have a lot of those moments.
Yeah, so as the Fram is coming down from being locked in the pack ice for 3 years,
uh-huh,
they stop off on Spitsbergen, which is the main island of an archipelago called Svalbard, which is fairly far north. Do you know anything about Svalbard?
I don't know anything about Svalbard.
Here's a fun fact about Svalbard. It is where the global seed bank is.
Huh.
So they basically have a repository of as many seeds as they possibly can. And it's very far north still. It's like 75 degrees north. And it's quite cold there. And the idea is, in event of global thermonuclear war, there's this giant radiation-proof vault in a mountain.
I did know about that.
Just needed to be jogged.
I just needed to be jogged. They mentioned that in the Maritime History Museum in Amsterdam.
Yeah, so it's... So that's... I couldn't name another thing about Svalbard, except there's lots of polar bears there now. So they stopped off there. And
uh-huh,
at the same time they were there, as they're going down, going up was a youngish Swede named Solomon André. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name.
That's how we're going to pronounce
his name. That's how we're going to pronounce his name. We're sorry. We'll appreciate any corrections.
Yes. Please send us on Twitter if there are corrections. He decides that he wants to do a different way of going to find the pole.
So what do you mean? I mean, we've seen people take boats there. We've seen people lock their boats in the ice and then take dog sleds and skis. How does he think he can get there? Remember, this is 1897, so...
So he decides that he is going to take a hot air balloon there.
He's going to take... Okay.
And it's not like those, like, romantic hot air balloon flights that you see in, like, 1950s movies. It's an exploring hot air balloon.
Okay.
And so he... The biggest problem with balloons, or hot air balloons, especially at this time, is that they're really hard to steer.
Yeah, and this would be fairly early in balloondom.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really early in balloondom, because otherwise they would have been like, this is a terrible idea.
Well, I feel like everyone was still like, this is a terrible idea when they heard of it.
Probably.
So how does, if he can't steer, how does he plan to...
So he creates this harebrained scheme of dragging ropes along the ice to steer the balloon.
Okay.
And he trains, he tries this a couple of times, and it seems to work in the short distances that he's going, so he thinks, yeah, I can totally go and find the North Pole with this.
And how does it work out?
Well, like pretty much all of our stories so far, it does not work very well. Almost immediately into their flight, they wind up losing the ropes that are supposed to steer.
Excellent.
And then they get kind of stuck in this drift, and the balloon starts to go sideways, and they wind up having to throw a bunch of sand overboard so that they don't plunge into the really cold water.
Mm-hmm.
This is like 10 hours into the flight or something like
okay.
this.
And it's supposed to be like a 5-week flight or a month-long flight.
Yeah, and this is not very long in at all. It's, 10 hours in, and they're tipping, and they have to pour sand out over, and then that leaves them with the problem that they don't really have anything to ground them anymore and keep them down, so the balloon starts rising up too high.
Okay.
And
beyond these benevolent winds that they were just assuming would push them directly to the North Pole, where all winds go.
Exactly! Everything comes there or goes there. Well, and they had the ropes, too, that were supposed to steer them there.
That's true. Well, that won't help if the wind blows south.
That's true. It will not. I mean, maybe if they're going to the South Pole. But yeah, so they're going too high. Because they're going too high, they start leaking helium. Because
mm-hmm.
they start leaking helium, they now no longer can go very high.
And it seems like it solves their problem.
But then they start bumping along the ice.
Mm.
And then about 65 hours into the trip. So, you know, they made it a couple of days.
Yeah.
Made it.
Probably very restful days.
Yeah. So they're like, we're bobbing along in a balloon. They crash.
Okay.
I mean, it's a fairly gentle crash at this point because they've been, like, bobbing along the ice.
Yeah, they realize it's kind of inevitable.
Yeah. And so they crash, but they are all unharmed at this point.
That's good.
Yeah. So, you know, it starts off okay. They're like, all right, we've crashed.
They get off. They take a few pictures.
Yeah, there's some really good pictures, which I'll post online, because there's some really interesting pictures of the way the balloon looks when it crashes. And they do have some provisions. They have guns, they have a tent, they have supplies, like, and all of them are apparently fairly adequate to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realize that they're actually not very adequate supplies, because they really hadn't made any plans for if they were going to crash.
Yeah, and they're not really explorers, are they?
No, they're men who were planning to sit in a balloon and go across.
And there's only three of them.
Yeah. So they're not really the type of people.
Yeah, and the long and short of it is they try to head back.
Yeah, they do some hiking. They set up camp. They again get stuck on an ice floe that winds up drifting away. And they wind up moving to a nearby island, and that's the like last recorded thing from them.
Yeah, so I believe they actually found them in the end. Eventually.
Not alive.
Not alive. Oh, goodness. Not alive.
Not alive. I was like, no, they don't. But yes, they do find them.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
relatively
preserved and,
frozen.
Preserved in ice. This seems to be, like, the theme.
Yeah, and they've done some research on them, and they've come to some fairly interesting conclusions, I think. So I think that one of them died from eating bad polar bear meat?
Yeah, I heard that, because I heard there's a number of theories about that, but yeah, bad polar bear meat, so...
And another one that suggested that maybe that it seems plausible that they were using a cooking stove inside their tent.
And just, like, burned to death? Or, like,
carbon monoxide?
Oh, I hadn't read that one.
So, yeah, so that's another theory of how the Andre expedition passed away.
I've heard also hypothermia and exhaustion.
I mean, those ones are very plausible, but... And I don't mean to bring you down, but not very interesting.
No, they're really quite boring.
Not as much fun as, you know, they accidentally suffocated themselves in their tent.
I would much prefer that they ate bad polar bear meat.
Exactly.
And accidentally suffocated. Well, not really. I would have preferred they probably lived, but I probably wouldn't do this podcast on them if they had lived.
It's true. Yeah, so it just kind of seems like they had this idea, and they got a bit carried away with it.
Yeah.
And... they were Swedish, so they really wanted, like, the Norwegians and Swedes have a fairly strong inferiority complex one way or the other.
Yeah.
And at this point, the Norwegians, you know, Nansen, and at the same time, Amundsen, who was busy conquering the Northwest Passage, were sort of the big titans of polar exploration at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Swedes were sort of like, well, we've got this guy who says he'll fly over it. So they gave tons of money and fanfare to him. And...
then he
crashed.
Well,
it turns out your fairly idiotic scheme didn't work.
Unfortunately. But one of the things, though, is when they did eventually find them, it was like 3 decades later, I think, they found their bodies.
Yeah.
They were able to find the camera that had actual footage of what they saw. And so this is essentially like the first expedition where we can actually see what happened.
Yeah. Which is super interesting. You can see the pictures of them with their... balloon right there, it's on the side.
Yeah, and like the stuff they encountered.
Yeah, so that's all, it's all very, very fast. It's much, it's a long, long ways away from leaving a couple of notes in the margins on a cairn.
And everything was fine, and now everything is awful.
Yeah, so they've come a long way in the 50 years from the Lost Franklin expedition.
They really have. Well, those are 4 really interesting stories.
Yeah, I think so.
Which one's your favorite?
Which, of the lot of them, I mean, Nansen's definitely, I find, the most fascinating person, because he looked at it and said, we're going to do this. And even though I think his idea was idiotic. Let's go lock a ship in the boat or in the ice.
See, I think it's less idiotic than a lot of the things that people were planning to do.
Well, it's less idiotic than a balloon. It's less idiotic than giving some dilettante command of a boat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also easy to look back with 2020 hindsight and be That's true. Well, obviously it's not going to take you up there because they didn't know. They didn't know that there was no warm polar sea.
Yeah.
They didn't know, you know, it was all unmapped. They didn't have a handy satellite or Google Maps to tell them, this is what it looks like. This is what I plan. Like, now, you know, the pole's been conquered, right?
Yeah.
Peary and Cook went there in the early 1900s, although that's since been disputed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, birds were flown over it in the 20s, although that's also since been disputed.
Yeah.
Amundsen went over it in a blimp. That one's pretty well confirmed.
Yeah.
You know, we in the sense of humankind, have sent submarines underneath it.
Yeah.
If you wanted, you could spend $10,000 to $20,000 and sign up to run a marathon at the North Pole now.
I do not want to do that. I'm a runner, and I do not want to do that.
I don't want to do that either, but mostly because I don't want to spend that much money or run that long. There's a lot of reasons, actually.
I don't want to run in that cold.
Summer's probably at least slightly above zero now, so...
I wouldn't mind running in slightly above zero, to be honest. Maybe I'll do this some point in my life.
Pay $20,000 for the privilege to run. Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Sometimes I make pro-life decisions.
So I think the Nansen is my favorite of the stories. And that has a happy ending, even though he basically just said, okay, bye, chaps. And basically got lucky that he bumped into this Jackson character, because who knows how many more winters they could have survived out there.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they could have survived for quite a long time. Oh, what are you wearing?
I think Hall is still possibly my favorite. Yeah. But I think that's more because I find murder mysteries really intriguing. Mm. And I really want to solve who killed Hall. But
you think it's Besson?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's got to be him. But yeah, I think that's why...
Or Bessel.
Bessel, yeah. But yeah, I think that's why the Hall one is the most entertaining to me, because there's so many personalities in it.
It does
as
have
well.
A very strong part. A lot of the other ones are dominated by a single strong personality.
I really like the multiple personalities, and I really like sort of the clusterfuck that it became. It's just kind of hilarious to hear that. But I really like Nansen as well. I think that one's really good.
I feel he's indisputably the best of the people, or at least the most high-functioning.
He's also the only one that lived.
That's true.
So he got to do more cool things because he came back.
That is very, very, very true.
Well, I think that is pretty much all we need to talk about.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thanks for having.
Okay, so that wraps up the second episode on our two-part series on polar exploration. So thanks again to Adam and Aaron for recording those for us. And of course, if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can find us at Tipsy Archives. Or if you want to email us, we're at thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And I just want to add a note. So the music that I've been using for the intro and outros are these great antique phonograph recordings that I found online for free. And the piece I chose for today's is by Lucille Hegeman and the Dixie Daisies, and it's called The Cold Winter Blues. So I'm just going to let a couple minutes of it play at the end here if you want to enjoy that. I think that this has been working really well to give the podcast that kind of an old-timey feel. So hopefully you enjoy that. And if you guys want to hear, you know, more music themed to podcast topics, or, you know, if we do something that takes place in France, we could play something that sounds a little bit more French, or we could play something from the time period. We're definitely always open to those kinds of suggestions. So hopefully you guys like that. Thanks again for listening, and please join us again. Than the light.
Thank you.